we need like our politicians and our public health officials, our doctors, our hospitals to say that like abortion access makes our state go round. It makes our state healthy, but we do have a lot of work to undo before that.
Herzlich willkommen bei What's Left, dem linken Podcast zur US-Wahl. Eine Koproduktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung WOTS und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Mein Name ist Lukas Hermsmeier, ich arbeite als freier Journalist in New York und ich werde bis November mit verschiedenen Gästen über die dringendsten Themen dieses Landes sprechen. Im Sommer 2022 fällte der Supreme Court, also der oberste Gerichtshof der USA, eines der folgenschwersten Urteile der vergangenen Jahrzehnte. Das landesweite Abtreibungsrecht wurde gekippt. Die Bundesstaaten können seitdem bestimmen, ob und unter welchen Bedingungen sie Abtreibungen erlauben. In 14 Staaten gibt es mittlerweile ein allgemeines Verbot. Dieses Urteil, die sogenannte Dobbs Decision, hatte einen Vorlauf. Die Republikanische Partei, andere rechte Kräfte und auch Kirchen hatten über Jahre darauf hinausgearbeitet. Und zur Geschichte gehört auch, dass die Democrats das Thema lange Zeit verpennt haben. Ich spreche heute mit Michaela Montoya Frazier, von der ich sagen würde, dass sie zu den beeindruckendsten Aktivistinnen im ganzen Land gehört. Michaela wohnt in San Antonio, Texas, wo der republikanische Gouverneur Greg Abbott den Beginn der Pandemie genutzt hatte, Abtreibungen zu verbieten, also schon 2 Jahre vor dem Urteil des Supreme Courts. Es gibt jedoch Loopholes, sagt Michaela, also Schlupflöcher im Gesetz. Sie hat einen Abortion Fund gegründet, die Buckle Bunnies. Es ist eine Gruppe von Freiwilligen, die Wege findet, Schwangeren bei Abtreibung zu helfen. Und das eben trotz der feindlichen Bedingungen. Michaela, welcome to the show, as they say.
Hello, happy to be here.
Thank you for taking the time. Let's start with the abortion fund you co-founded in 2020, the Buckle Bunnies. What made you start this collective?
Yeah, so back in 2020, I was about 20 years old, and Greg Abbott had banned abortion at the beginning of COVID. He used that as kind of his in to ban abortion, saying it was an elective procedure. So for about a month, people in Texas could not access an abortion at a clinic, and it was really hard for them to even travel out of state because of all of the COVID traveling restrictions, like the airports, the hotels, and the other clinics and stuff like that. So we decided, oh, we should just get together and let people know that they have options, not just traveling out of state, but abortion pills by mail. We think that provided a lot more dignity in our community than they were being, the information that they were already being given. So we decided to do that. And it started off with just this small $3,000 goal. And from there, kind of just doubled and tripled. And four and a half years later, you know, we've helped almost 20,000 people access abortion through financial material support.
I was about to ask that, given the grim situation in Texas, what is your fund exactly doing? So how do you help people with abortions in a state where abortions are so heavily criminalized?
So we've never let the law scare us out of doing what is right, because we believe that what is right is to use the information and the resources that we've accumulated over the years and just keep going. We're very lucky to have lawyers who've kind of paved a way of loopholes for so many people and so many abortion funds. So, you know, funding abortion travel is still legal. Funding abortion out of state is still legal. Even if we were to help somebody within the state pay for their abortion through like a medical exception, that would still be legal. So there's loopholes around what the abortion law currently is. We're helping people with a lot of prevention. We don't do it in a way to where we're like, oh, we're trying to prevent abortion. Like, no, we're trying to prevent people from having to jump through these hoops and barriers that have been placed by the state of Texas. So we do Plan B pregnancy testing and then self-managed abortion information. So if people do want abortion pills by mail, we give them that information, and we have never stopped giving that information. So that makes us a little bit different from some of the other funds.
Has the state of Texas tried to prosecute you because of this, because of you pushing the law?
Yes and no. So it's like it's an individual thing, sort of. So we have individuals in Texas with either, you know, extremist anti-abortion organizations or just some random state representatives, friends, cousins, uncle, like just it can be so random and they can just choose one person to go after. So like there's this woman who is attacking me directly through the legal system, through Jonathan Mitchell. And she is trying to say that possibly Buckle Bunnies might know of abortions that violated the 6-week abortion ban. And so it's just a very like, so anybody can say kind of anything. And the anti-abortion people are just going to do that in court. They're just going to run with it. So we've been a part of around 4 or 5 legal situations, lawsuits, possible lawsuits, subpoenas and cease and desist in the past couple of years. We're currently still in about 3, but we don't see why that would, you know, make us stop at any time. They're not that scary because we know we're doing what's right.
And what kind of people usually seek out your help? What would be like a common case, or is that too difficult to describe because it's such a spectrum? Who seeks your help?
I can give you a good range, like a good like demographic range. So like the youngest person we've had is say 11, and the oldest person we've had is around 47, 48. But I would say typically we see a lot of people who are already parents, who already have children, at least one or more, who are low income, who are struggling with finding the travel aspect for the most part. And for those people, then we share the gospel, if you will, of self-managed abortion and abortion pills by mail, because travel might not be within their abortion plans. And so it's up to us as an abortion fund who does not feel constrained by a nonprofit status because we don't have one, to share that information in a way that other funds can't. So I would say we get some of the most vulnerable members of the community because have that trust and have that reputation of being able to help no matter the circumstance.
Because you're mentioning that you're not an NGO, that you're a mutual aid collective, how does that suit your aims or your way of organizing better? Why is it better to be a more, maybe let's call it underground collective and not like an official nonprofit?
Yeah, so we've always been like a pretty non-hierarchy, horizontal organization. Mutual aid is kind of how I got into organizing in the first place. So I knew that that's a structure that would fit not only my organizing best, but like the organizing that I were to lead. So we decided to just keep that going because we would have been, I don't know if it would have been like, we would have had issues with crime adjacent activity probably because of the way abortion is so weirdly vaguely criminalized in Texas. Some of the information that we give out could possibly, you know, lead to somebody doing abortion at their own house, and the people who hold the money, like big nonprofit heads and the philanthropists, they don't want to give money to projects like that. And we would have then the risk of the banks just freezing that money because maybe we're doing something that Texas could perceive as a crime. So we always knew that we needed to like just skirt around that. And that helps us in the way that whenever we do have lawsuits or subpoenas or cease and desist, they have to come at us as individuals. They can't come at us as a whole organization because we aren't an organization. We're just a gaggle of bitches who got together and funded abortion. So in all the lawsuits, I either have to be named or somebody else has to be named directly. So it's really funny because it kind of just like wastes their time. They have to run around and waste their money trying to figure out who are these people? How many of them are there? So it's kind of fun.
But you don't sound intimidated at all. Have there been no points where you thought, is what I'm doing here how I how I want to continue to help? Because it is like constantly causing some antagonistic forces, the right wing to and the state to prosecute you. Have there been no points where you're doubting?
There has been a couple. I think it's been like some moments of my visibility as the leader of the organization, where I have felt so vulnerable and out in the open that I was like, am I doing the right thing? Am I saying the right thing? Am I going to get in trouble? Whenever there's big subpoenas written, there's like then 52 pages where people are just accusing me over and over, paragraph of being a murderer and breaking the federal, you know, the state's laws and things like that. Telling me that I deserve to go to prison for 100 years, like in legal documents. And so at some points, because I think I was like 23 the first time I read a document like that about myself, I really freaked out because I was young. But that was the intention, was to make me so scared that in hopes that I would give up, that I would stop. But that's why I've like surrounded myself with such great organizers as well, because we're all going to need each other eventually. So to be able to have them pull me out of that kind of fear that just ruminates in myself is really helpful. But I know that other people in my organization have felt that way before, but nobody I would think is more terrified than our patients. Individually, every single day, every single time, we have 30 people contact us a day. Almost every one of those people is more scared than I am.
Totally. That makes sense. I would like to zoom out a little bit. How would you summarize, has the situation changed since the Supreme Court ruling in 2022? That took away the constitutional right to abortion. What have been the main consequences of that decision?
I think not only is it like such a local impact, we've seen abortion funds across the nation not be able to close these gaps that they once were able to close, especially for Texas patients, because Texas patients always had to travel. It wasn't just, you know, after SB8 or after Dobbs or anything like that, but it was so much easier for that travel funding to be covered. And now every single fund is at maximum capacity. The National Abortion Federation is at maximum capacity. So smaller funds like us are then having to basically go into debt every single month because we don't believe in saying no, because that's literally would be us like standing in the way of somebody being able to get what they need.
Do you sometimes have to say no? Do you sometimes have to turn away people, or is that?
We always offer something. If it's not, you know, we can't close this $1,000 gap, this $4,000 gap, because we've seen the prices get so astronomical, we're at least always able to offer a couple hundred. And then we kind of fundraise based off of that gap as well. Like, okay, we were only able to offer, you know, 300 and this person needed 600, can we fundraise really quick to get that other 300, which is not sustainable model for fundraising and distribution.
And these are mainly cases where people leave Texas to go to a different state to get an abortion, right?
Oh yeah, pretty much all of them. I would say at least like 60% of our cases right now are people who have to leave Texas because they're either so far along or they want that abortion experience, not the abortion experience of being at home and maybe not having access to a provider.
Der What's Left Podcast zu den US-Wahlen ist eine Co-Produktion der Schweizer Wochenzeitung WOTS und der deutschen Monatszeitung Analyse und Kritik. Beide Redaktionen haben Personal und Zeit investiert. Finanziert wird der Podcast vom Recherchierfonds Pro WOTS. Wenn Sie mithelfen wollen, dass Projekte dieser Art auch in Zukunft umgesetzt werden können, spenden Sie auf prowotz.ch und abonnieren Sie eine oder gleich beide Zeitungen.
And since we are talking about money, I think it is important, probably mainly or specifically for European listeners, to explain how much this is an economic issue, right? Like how would you describe how and where class comes into play? Like how is it an economic issue?
Yeah, because it really does start for people from like the very beginning of their reproductive years. If they're not able to access what they need in those reproductive years, and then, you know, something happens and they have a child that they don't feel equipped for, then that's kind of the rest of their lives. That kind of sets the tone for the rest of their life and the rest of the opportunities that they're going to have. We've had patients who had to have children that they maybe would have chose differently about. But now they have these kids and they have struggles taking care of these children that they wouldn't have had. They would have, you know, maybe been able to have a different job, go to school, things that, you know, they deserved but didn't have the option. And we've had a lot of cases like that and seen a lot of cases like that. And unfortunately, it happened, you know, before Dobbs as well. And it's going to be majority teenagers, really young people, people who don't have the means to travel whatsoever, people who live along the border and can't get out of that 100-mile checkpoint zone. That's typically where we see the most of those cases.
So it is deeply related also to issues like immigration, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's going to impact young people, disabled people the most.
Would you say that what the Republican Party and other conservative right-wing forces have done there to create this atmosphere where there are so many loopholes, which is maybe sometimes of advantage for abortion funds, but also where there's so much uncertainty. Is that uncertainty, like confusion about the rules, part of this strategy?
Yeah, it always has been, really just letting that fear and that panic get to people through misinformation and through just scare tactics that they've kind of always been using. I mean, you see it on the crisis pregnancy centers, the pregnant, scared, like, we can help you. Like, they're preying on that fear within people because they've made this abortion situation so scary. Like, abortion isn't inherently scary, but they have made it that way. And so a lot of our job has been correcting that misinformation, bringing some joy and some lightheartedness to abortion, and just kind of like acting as companions with these people, not as just like the keepers of all of this knowledge. So kind of just being at the same level, because we've all been in our patients' shoes, has really helped kind of calm down that fear. And I think also being experts in what we do and what we know has really helped. Like, we should be very, very confident in the way we're talking about abortion, because the loopholes, they do work in our favor, and we have to exploit them for as long as the Republicans look away.
Could you explain real quick what these crisis pregnancy centers do? Because you're calling them fake clinics, right? Why do you think they are fake clinics?
Yeah, so crisis pregnancy centers, also known as fake clinics, they're anti-abortion centers in not only Texas, but a majority of them are in Texas. So Texas allocates billions of dollars to them through the Alternatives for Abortion program. So they're marked as a charity, a religious nonprofit, through taxes, so they don't have to pay taxes. But they're just fake medical facilities that are there to deceive people who come to them for pregnancy resources or for STI, HIV resources. So they tell people, like, you can get tested here, you can get ultrasounds here, diapers, clothes and whatnot. But their real goal is to preach to you about Christianity. So in order to get services from them, you have to listen to what they say. And it's really dehumanizing.
Have you ever had a situation where you succeeded in changing someone's position? Or is the field of abortion rights one of those where people are too hardened and where it's almost impossible to win someone over by through arguments? Have you ever encountered a situation like this?
A lot of the time we don't waste our time like talking to people who are maybe on the other side when we could be mobilizing people who are on our side. But when I was doing, you know, door knocking for abortion ordinances, I would talk to some people, especially like the colleges, and I would say, oh, if you knew somebody who was pregnant and they were going to get an abortion, wouldn't you want them to have access to a safe abortion? And that's kind of just the whole gist, because if they say no, they're admitting it right then and there, that they think that the person should essentially be punished for wanting an abortion. And so it puts them in that position to be like, man, it's really, I have to remove myself from this. It's not about me. It's about other people's decisions and other people's health and safety. So from a public health perspective, hell yeah, I want everybody to access healthcare safely.
And would you say, speaking about now the other side, the resistance, what you are part of, would you say that the Supreme Court decision in 2022 has sparked a new movement for abortion rights? Are there like many other abortion funds who do similar work in other states than what the Buckle Bunnies do?
I would say we saw a little bit of that before the Dobbs decision, abortion funds kind of just springing up and being like, huh, I need this. Like, and there's gaps in my state, in my city that maybe I didn't notice before, but because of the abortion, the rumors that are going on about the Supreme Court and what happened in Texas with SB, like maybe this is something my community needs. And so we had a lot of that going on prior to Dobbs, and that was really nice. I would say after Dobbs, a lot of people want to be mobilized more as volunteers, which is incredibly helpful, other than starting their own organizations, because some of it becomes a little oversaturated and there's so much information out there that it just wires get crossed. So it has been really helpful getting new people into abortion through either like funding or self-managed abortion in a way that they weren't before. I feel like self-managed abortion has become such a normalized thing, where 6 years ago when I had my first abortion and it was surgical, I had no idea that I could just like have some pills at home and go to town, you know? And if I would have known that, I would have chosen differently. And so being able to now like share this information so widespread and have such a good response and know that I'm telling someone this and they're going to tell their circle and they're going to tell their families and people are going to use that information. I think that's something we hadn't seen prior to Dobbs.
There also have been several referendums since 2022, right? And correct me if I'm wrong, but in all of those states, the people said yes to abortion rights when they were asked directly. What do you make out of that fact that people in some red states where the Republican Party governs, that like some people or even many people vote for a party that is banning abortions and then vote in favor of abortion rights? How would you explain that?
I think when we see people vote for individuals rather than for issues, that's when things get a little topsy-turvy for the most part. I mean, we've seen it in San Antonio. San Antonio is like a pretty blue place, but we have a history of electing like corrupt conservative freaks. So I think it's also a thing about who is voting, and that has some, you know, a lot to do with voter suppression and, you know, the gerrymandering of the districts, especially in Texas, especially in San Antonio. So it's, I think this is the statewide thing in Texas. It's rough, and it's probably going to stay rough because those people have been in power for as long as they've been in power for a reason. People keep putting them there through money, through false legal means, and it's all corrupt and it's going to stay corrupt. I hate it here a little bit because I hate them. But I have a lot of, right now, it might be misguided, so we'll see. But a little more faith in local politics than I have had in the past couple of years, because we do have people on our city council saying abortion and talking about abortion in a really positive light. So I think that shows the voters and the community and their constituents that abortion is a winning issue and is a popular issue. But we've also had ballot, you know, measures lose here in San Antonio as well.
Mm. Are you hopeful that this gonna continue? There will be more referendums in November. For example, in Florida, a huge state where there is a 6-week ban, like very, very drastic restrictions. Could you imagine that this that like one state after the other is voting now in favor of abortion rights, or will there be a stop at some point?
I think that it might keep going. I am a little skeptical about Florida, just because like you never know what's going on with Florida. You don't know what she's going to do, especially statewide. I have no idea. But I also have a lot of faith in the Florida organizers and the people of Florida who have abortions and who love people who have abortions. I think that Florida is full of people who have had abortions, actually. So I think that voting for them would be an act of love within their own community. So I think it's like about time their community showed them that love. And I think a lot of states, especially states where there's bans, like the 6-week bans or total bans, a lot of them did not realize what they had until it was gone. Like Texas, people in Texas didn't think there was an abortion access issue until SB 8. And even then, maybe some of those people...
And SB 8 was?
The 6-week, the heartbeat ban. Also the bounty hunter law, which...
That was introduced in 2021 already in Texas, right? So before the Supreme Court decision.
Yeah, we had already been living under an almost total abortion ban for a while before that. And we're still in silly lawsuits about it. So it's that to me, I think, was one of the most stressful abortion times ever, because people didn't understand how much that would just cut access off just completely. So, I mean, that prepared us for Dobbs, unfortunately. But yeah, now we've pretty much gotten used to the reality of living in a total abortion ban state. And we probably will for a while until somebody does something. In San Antonio, there's been a couple like successful little resolutions or like budget amendments and whatnot. But as like a widespread thing, there hasn't been much talk at the ledge or anything of that nature. Mm. Not yet.
Could you imagine that the Republican Party will at some point change their politics on this? If they see like more and more states, like more and more people voting in favor of abortion rights, or do you think they will double down and like go for a nationwide ban? What do you anticipate for the next years?
I mean, I feel like we've actually been seeing like a rise in the Republicans' right-wing extremism. I feel like it's gotten worse. And the rhetoric has been more dangerous, and there's been more attacks on abortion organizers and abortion providers, not just like in person, but a lot like online stuff has become pretty scary. So I think that's directly fueled by Republicans and their rhetoric about abortion and about how we're murderers, so maybe we deserve to be killed, and that type of talk, it actually is dangerous and harms people. So I don't think it's going to get better. I actually anticipate it getting worse, because nobody's doing anything about it for the most part, like being like, hey, this is wrong. Like, if you hate abortion because you love God, then maybe threatening to kill abortion providers is extremely bad.
So you're not expecting that this topic will bring people to the ballot in November? Because if we look back at the last, look back to the midterms, right, in 2022, it was one of the issues people said why they voted for the Democratic Party in the end. And I'm aware that that is not enough, but do you expect people, this is going to be a key issue in November, or... Not so much.
I think so. I mean, I think because of the Project 2025 talk, whatever, I think that's one of the things that's kind of motivating people to vote for Kamala in the first place, is like, oh, Donald Trump wants a total abortion ban, or it's going to ban immigration completely, or just like very, you know, a couple issues, which, you know, stresses me out a little bit, because I'm like, man, if y'all care about singular issues, you would get involved in those issues without the threat of a presidential election, but whatever. So I definitely think it will motivate people to vote. But I also think that those people who are going to vote for Biden are still the same people who are going to vote for Kamala. I don't see much of a difference there.
Would you say the Democratic Party is doing enough to protect abortion rights?
No.
What would you want them to do?
Well, I'd like them to start trying, actually. I think that would be really fun if they put their money where their mouth was and started proposing anything. Visit an abortion clinic, support an abortion clinic monetarily, show your constituents that abortion providers in your community matter. Actually talk to abortion workers and see what we need. I think it's just a lot of people being left out of the conversation, and there's legislation about us without us. And we see that a lot with a lot of legislation. But this, if it's going to be a winning issue, they need to talk to the people who are going to win it, because it's going to be us and not them. If they want us to mobilize our communities, and they have to talk to us, because we were providing the abortions. We want abortion to be legal. We want the Democrats to do that for us if they can. But from what we've seen, they can't. So
totally, yeah. Why is it not enough to go back to the situation before the Supreme Court ruling? Because it's often said, like, let's restore Roe, right? Why is that not enough, in your opinion?
I think people in blue states have, like, a really easy time saying that. Majority, because, like, they're so comfortable with the legal system that they were living under that they didn't even bat an eye when Texas was living in a six-week ban before that. Georgia had lived in a six-week ban before that. Louisiana, all of these states where, you know, people have historically been disenfranchised, continued to be disenfranchised. And so saying, like, restore Roe is rich coming from states where there is legal abortion access. Even if it's, you know, has a cutoff, it's still more than Texas has had in the past few years. And even with Roe, people were still in my state, in my direct community, struggling to access an abortion. Abortion clinics were closing at an alarming rate in Texas before SB8. Even like 6 years ago, when I was having my first abortion, 2 months after my abortion, the clinic closed down because people in the neighborhood decided they didn't want a clinic there. So they got the zoning commission to just get it out of the city. And that was really harmful to my entire neighborhood, my entire side of town, because it was the only abortion provider within the South Side, East Side, West Side area whatsoever. So it was a bad situation, just compounded by more bad situations. So I think that restoring Roe wouldn't help people like me, people who are in Texas, people who are in banned states, period. We'd have to undo so much before we could even do that.
Do you expect to see that in your lifetime?
Girl, I hope so. Oh my God, how embarrassing would it be if, like, I was doing all this work and, like, it never... I'd be so mad. I know it'll take a lot of work, though, because first we have to undo the, you know, SB8, SB7, like, all of these small things in order to achieve, like, a big thing, like restoring abortion access as a whole country, or restoring abortion access to even, like, the state. So I think that, yeah, it can happen, but I think it's going to take, like, 20, 30 years. And I'm patient. I can play the long game. I've been playing it. But I really hope that we can all just, like, make this a really important issue that Texas cares about. Like, Texas has abortions all the time. So we need, like, our politicians and our public health officials, our doctors, our hospitals, to say that, like, abortion access makes our state go round. It makes our state healthy. But we do have a lot of work to undo before that. We literally pump so much money into our crisis pregnancy centers. So there's money in anti-abortion.
I'm going to ask every guest on the show the two same questions in the end. One is, what aspect of your work, in this case, abortion rights, gets too much attention? What do we talk about too much?
Oh, I think we talk a lot about the most dramatic, horrible, trauma porn cases. We talk about the people who are, you know, when we're talking to someone who's anti-abortion, like, what if this person was dying? What if this person was 12? Like, just all of these things that we actually don't have to say. We don't have to exploit vulnerable people's situations as some sort of gotcha to antis. That's because that's not the majority of people who have abortions. The majority of people who have abortions are regular gals regular people, just like me. So saying something that is so like triggering is to me not the point of what we're trying to do. If we're trying to normalize abortion as a common medical procedure, we can't just go to the extremes every single time because it's kind of disgusting.
Yeah. And then finally, what are we not talking about enough?
I'll always say that I don't think we're all talking about self-managed abortion enough. I think that self-managed abortion could be just this huge, widespread, beautiful movement for people in banned states to really sink their teeth into and to be like, this is mine. Although abortion was taken away from me in this way, abortion is mine through this way. And it's not just about the people who are having the pills at 6 weeks. Like, people can do the pills until much later in their pregnancy, and they always have been. So supporting those people and then talking about how that information can empower them, I think, is always life-saving and important work.
Mikaela, thank you so much. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Yes, of course. Always happy to chat.
Das war Mikaela Montoya-Frazier, die in Texas für das Recht auf Abtreibung kämpft. Das Thema spielt im Wahlkampf eine wesentliche Rolle. Donald Trump hat zwar in den vergangenen Wochen Andeutungen gemacht, dass er Abtreibung doch unterstützt, aber wie viele seiner Aussagen sind auch diese widersprüchlich. Die Republikaner stehen unter dem Strich immer noch deutlich hinter den Verboten. In unserem Gespräch hat Mikaela allerdings klargemacht, dass sie auch von demokratischer Seite wesentlich mehr erwartet als nur Lippenbekenntnisse, vor allem materielle Unterstützung für die Abortion Funds vor Ort. Fest steht, dass die große Mehrheit der amerikanischen Bevölkerung für das Recht auf Abtreibung ist. In neuen Umfragen sagen sogar 41% der republikanischen WählerInnen, dass Abtreibungen in allen oder fast allen Fällen legal sein sollten. In der nächsten Folge von What's Left spreche ich mit dem Historiker Adam Tooze über die US-Wirtschaft. Es geht unter anderem um die Frage, ob die Wirtschaftspolitik von Biden wirklich einen Bruch mit dem Neoliberalismus eingeleitet hat, wie oft behauptet, und es geht auch um die Konkurrenz mit China. Vielen Dank fürs Zuhören. Dieser Podcast ist eine Koproduktion von der WOTS und Analyse und Kritik, finanziert durch den WOTS Recherchierfonds. Am Podcast beteiligt sind Ua Gültekin, Kaspar Surber, Jan-Ole Arps, Payam Masumi, Helen Derik und Lukas Hermsmeier.